As classroom architecture goes, aside from the small spaces that are unusable because they have no windows and no natural light, or because, like room 940, they are endlessly long and completely shallow, this is unquestionably the worst room in the building. It is airless, and it has a single half-wide entrance and exit, and you know all about this. And I'm only pointing this out because we are here because I moved us out of 105, which is an acceptable place to teach, in order to accommodate all the people who have enrolled and who are going to fill the room. I always think, when I have changed to larger but lesser premises, it's okay, I will just teach badly, and then people will drop, and then we can move back into reasonable housing. But of course, that isn't what happened, as you know. We are here in this horrible room to accommodate all the people who don't come but are still enrolled. I did not actually teach badly enough to cause them to drop. I merely gave them the impression that they didn't have to show because, A, the recordings are available immediately, not on Zoom. You can actually skip around in them, and etc. And there is no exam. There are only two little essays, and anybody can do that. And so people remain enrolled, but there's nothing to show up for. At least that's the apparent view of people other than yourselves. I'm grateful to you, of course, for doing this, because otherwise the room could be literally empty and the only person subjected to the airlessness and horribleness of it would be me. It's kind of you to share the penalty. But as you may have discovered, and of course not everybody has because I'm not done yet, these two essays are not quite so simple. It's not quite the gut that everybody seems to think it is, because editing is important and rewriting is challenging. The other thing that the papers show, I have one more batch of drafts to return. I was up at 4:30 this morning. I really thought I would be finished, but I'm not. I will be done within another couple of days. Thursday's always bad, but Friday I should be fine, and Saturday should give me room. So everybody will have drafts edited by the end of the weekend. But one of the things that the drafts, current drafts show, is, of course, that my effort to divide the two semesters of this conjoint offering into the private law over here and the public law over there suffers from the fundamental incoherence of the distinction between public and private law. I know that that's an incoherent distinction. I try to maintain it in these courses. It will not work. And, of course, as you show in your writing, it's really hard to think about the question of the power of the state in the networked society without winding up thinking about Facebook and moderation and the IP and all these other issues, which I love to think of as having, you know, disposed of in December. There may be some people for whom editing the drafts that you have written so far and thinking about the next draft, it would be useful to go back and listen to some of the stuff I had to say in the fall about the issues you are writing about. I've tried to cite to past lectures last term for those who might find them useful. But I don't consider it in that sense to be a cumulative effort, right? I mean, writing about questions of the private platforms here instead of the government relations to the same people who are eaten by the platforms is perfectly fine to do. I don't have any objection. I don't think, oh, but you didn't take my course, how can you write about that? Yet there are indeed some things that I have tried to indicate when you may not have been in the room, whichever room that was, which are helpful in thinking about the relation of the private powers to the public ones. I have, of course, a substantive claim to make with respect to how governments ought to treat the private powers, and that claim is a U.S.-centric claim based upon the peculiar and generative power of the First Amendment's equality principle, which I am claiming exists. All of this is, I'm sure somebody will be kind enough to remind me, a house of cards. The question, after all, is if Congress may make no law which has the effect of abridging freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and petition government for redress of grievances, if that conveys an affirmative responsibility to government, it may make no law at any level which has those abridging effects, and therefore, in some square brackets that I think are justifiable, it has a responsibility instead to make laws that don't do that abridging, that it has a responsibility to make laws that protect the freedom of speech and of the press, and from that, the freedom of thought. If government has an obligation to do that, then technology design, the way tech works, is subject to some forms of shaping pressure by government. That's always the way the powers in government, that is to say, the spooks and the cops, think about it. They always think that it's government's responsibility not merely to create the tools that they need to do their listening and their spying and their law enforcement and so on. They also think that government should use its authority to buy and sell and regulate to shape the way private market technology works. The most obvious such controversy in the present world is the constant effort by the prosecutors, acting on their own behalf, and the spooks, to change the way encryption works in the digital devices that you use. The constant effort to say that there should be backdoors into people's phones and other forms of services. That's like the Clinton administration's desire to use the government's power in purchasing telephones to require all digital telephones to have a backdoor through the so-called Clipper chip, the big controversy of the mid-1990s. So it's not as though I am making an extraordinary statement in suggesting that if the way the constitutional rights order works in the United States is the government may make no law abridging freedom of the press, then it cannot make broadcasting law, and it must make law, to the extent it makes any law at all, for the open web and the ability of everybody to write and read without the surveillance of the state, except for special and good cause shown, what we might call probable cause, to go back to the Fourth Amendment universe. So I'm going to be speaking on the premise for the remainder of this term that those three legs we are always posing on, tech and law and politics, are directly interrelated. We can't just accept the technology as somehow given, either given from the point of view of law or given from the point of view of politics, and we cannot accept it as given even with respect to ourselves. A sociological academic whom I used to be in touch with from time to time on business matters wrote to me yesterday, or maybe it was Monday. He's working on a quantitative research team at Harvard, and he's investigating the relationship between the attitudes of pro-privacy people and their behavior. And so he wanted to conduct a little bit of loose, I would say, qualitative analysis by interviewing me and some other people about what do we really do as opposed to what do we say. The thesis of which implicitly, of course, is probably we don't do what we say. We are less actually caring for our privacy than what we tell other people they should. And I was amused. I thought, am I going to talk to you at all? If I'm going to talk to you at all, am I actually going to discuss tradecraft? You know, pros don't talk about their tradecraft, for fuck's sake. You think I'm going to tell you how I keep the NSA out of my back drawer? And then I thought, yeah, you got me. I really have to, because otherwise I'm going to be complicit with this myth of the hypocrisy or weak-willedness or whatever it is that you think you're going to prove. And then I thought to myself, shit, you're really going to talk to the guy? You're going to need 10,000 words to explain all the stuff you do that nobody else in the world does, and how much further you go than everybody else, and why securing one laptop is not really very tough when you're actually constantly securing a 40-node private cloud against the best team in the world, which has the right to screw you any way it can because you're still two hops from Edward Snowden and there's nothing you can do about it. And I realized if I'm really going to do this, then, well, then I'm never going to finish editing the draft. But why don't I just combine the two activities? After all, that's what I started doing last week. What I need to do is to explain to you what I think, if government actually had an obligation to protect the freedoms of its people from spying outside and to subject its listening to the rule of law and to prevent private power from negligently or in an unregulated fashion destroying rights it is government's responsibility to preserve, if we actually imagined for a moment a government whose view is that it increases domestic tranquility and produces the common prosperity and all the other things we like to talk about in the preambles of our Constitution, if government actually did that, what would it be helping you to do and how? That actually seems to me to be the most important way to use this wonderful time we have in this room together, at which most of the people in the room will not be present. And it would actually be the best way to help explain how to make your writing on the subject more substantively forceful, by at least presenting a possibility that any particular draft might choose to reject or approve of or discuss or simply ruminate about. What would happen if, instead of thinking of this world as one in which there is essentially untrammeled private power seeking to know everything about you all the time and use it to make other people richer, and what if there weren't government willing to accept that because it likes to collect the scraps that fall off the table and because those richer people contribute heavily to the purchasing of government? If we were just to imagine all of that away, what would your technology look like? And to me, this is not a hypothetical, though it will be for you. I'm not going to bring props again. I've done enough of lugging hardware into the room just for the fuck of it. But I think it's important to point out that everything I am going to talk about exists, is in use, more than is in use, and more than exists, and is merely sort of a depreciated version of what I assume in my own life all the time, every single minute. So that whatever it is that we are talking about, it is always fair to put up your hand and say, really? Really? You can do that? Yes, I do that every day, every single day. I would never omit to do it. My life, it depends upon all these things that do exist that nobody gets to use. Why? Because government is not interested in encouraging their use or helping people to use them or educating people to use them or subsidizing their use or helping to compete the things that really work well against the things that really just screw you in the dark. Because freedom exists when another future is known to be possible. And so we actually have to conduct a plausible investigation about what is possible and how little it would take for government to throw the switches which over a relatively short period of time would replace what is with what ought to be if it cared. Which is essentially the same proposition as whether government wishes the planet to burn. Because these are now fundamentally similar social processes. The economic system of the society in which you live will not be the existing one at the end of your lifetime. We can be sure of that. we behave from day to day in law school as though that weren't true, but you know that this continuity is coming. The last part of the IPCC report released earlier this week demonstrates the truth of that. Either we will decarbonize the world's economies or the planet will burn. No matter which actually happens, at the other end of your life, the economic system of the world, of the society in which you live, will be different, either because the society has decarbonized or because the planet is burning. So it doesn't make any sense to study as though continuity were the fundamental underlying truth of the political economy of your time. You will be lawyers in a world in which the political economy of the society in which you practice is fundamentally changing. Nothing can prevent that from being true. And yet, we go on. As Scott Fitzgerald says at the end of The Great Gatsby, like boats ceaselessly beating against the current, borne back into the past. That's law school for you. But not only law school, after all. That's also what even Meta, which used to be Facebook, wants to think. And Google wants to think. And yet. So, for a second week, I'm now going to try to lay out what I think the technology structures are that are involved. Then, despite the misbehavior of Columbia University, we will begin technical exercises. I haven't decided whether technical exercises should replace the second essay. I think not. I think it would still be desirable if you would write a second essay draft, and if it were to arrive here, to arrive on the wiki not later than the last day of class, so that I can read it and you can revise it. However, those people who choose to come to the classroom will have a great power and responsibility next week. Because if I come in here and you say, we have all decided that we would like just to do technical exercises and actually to take them seriously and prove to you that we have mastered the technologies of privacy that are available to us to have easily and for free, and damn the second essay, I will defer to you. So here is your power for coming to class. Next week you will decide. Either you have canceled the second essay for everybody, or you have decided that yours and theirs will arrive a week following and follow the lead. And I do this not because I'm tired of editing. I'm not tired of editing. I would be happy to do another 54,000 words of drafts and another 54,000 words of edits for you. That would not bother me. I like it. But I also think that the concentration on technology is of increased importance. I think this because something is going on in the New York City public schools this week, which is interesting to me. Principals are tearing out their hair, assuming that they have hair, which principals sometimes don't. And they are writing to their parents in their public schools. I have now seen 8 of these anguished cries from principals in public elementary and secondary schools in New York City, all of whom are saying to parents, please, 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 please magically teach your children proper and appropriate use of devices. Because we can't, and our classrooms are completely out of control because kids are on phones all the time, and 9-year-olds have too many phones, and our fourth grade classrooms aren't working. Please will you teach your children how to be responsible in their use of devices? An excellent diffusion to parents, you know, of the work that schools can't do. But for the moment, more important to me because of the recognition that in the course of the epidemic, the bond between people and the devices has tightened ever further. I used to refer to the smart-ass phone as behaviorally implanted in the human being, right? The neuron that is the smart-ass phone, the neuron that connects you to the network and that spies on you, that neuron, that master neuron of the connection between network technology and the human being was already, let us say 5, 8, even 10 years ago, already behaviorally implanted in human beings. You know what I mean? Every time you think to yourself, which I hope you now do once a month or so just because, I wonder, could I leave the phone at home? And you realize that you can't, but you don't know why. My default assumption, if I'm not headed to the law school or to class or to the classroom in particular, my default assumption is that I walk around New York City without any electronic devices on me of any kind, much of the time with no metal on me of any kind. Once again, of course, this is why if I actually write back to Adam Tanner and I explain what it is that I do, it will seem not hypocritical, but just crazy. How could I de-implant from myself all these objects that I have spent all my life with? I have been a daily user, and user would be a slight term, of email since I was 14 years old in 1973. That none of this is any less familiar to me as the infrastructure of life than it is to you, and yet it's harder for me to carry a phone out of my apartment than to leave it there, because I have to have a reason to bring such an object. And we're not, of course, talking about a smart-ass phone. Even just the thing that radios to towers to tell them I am here, tweet, 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 is not acceptable. But that's okay. That would be a decision for people, right? Unless the decision had already been made, because the human reflex is to keep bonded to that neuron, keep it charged, keep it working. Don't ever leave it away. Don't ever be without it. What would happen if somebody wanted to talk to me and I wasn't there? Now, the question, where should those kinds of life practices be formed, will in a society like this one usually be answered by at school, where we socialize human beings. But it isn't. I don't just mean it isn't in the sense that good digital hygiene is not taught in fifth grade. I don't just mean that no laptops in class rules are stupid. It's worse than that. That's what the principal's letters are showing. The principal's letters are showing that school is giving up on the idea that it is where people are socialized to technological possibilities and practices and the difference between appropriate or inappropriate or productive or unproductive. The school is not strong enough to do that job, because the behavioral implantation of the devices during the long period of isolation which children and adults went through together has tightened the behavioral connection between people and the devices that control them. It is therefore more urgent than it was before to figure out how, even once we are in and all of this has happened and we're grown up and we have been monitored by Google since our parents disclosed us to Google slightly before we were born, even in such a world, even where that private power that you can't quite ever subtract away while you're trying to think about government, even while it grows so overwhelmingly powerful that it has what it has made of human nature on its side, still, we can imagine both architecture that will end that power and processes of teaching and learning in society that would enable that technology to be favored by societies. Technology that works to maintain people's rights instead of works to produce a stream of revenue large enough to buy politics and sustain itself, which is not to say that politics will then virtuously abandon the money. It won't. The relationship between the telecoms providers, those guys in the middle, and the governments has always been overwhelmingly close. I have referred before in this room to the NSA's code name for AT&T. Just to remind you, the NSA has always, changes all kinds of buzzwords and code names all the time, but not this one. AT&T has been referred to for all of my adult lifetime inside NSA as fair play. To understand then the relationship relationship between government's physiological relationship, the relationship between the physiology of government and the physiology of telecoms companies has always been to imagine two parts of the same central nervous system. In much of the 20th century, in much of the developed societies, that relationship was one of ownership. The government owned the telecom. It was the great work of the form of globalization we called neoliberalism in the 1990s that it disseminated the rule that government should not own the telecoms, it should merely be owned by them. It should just flirt with them. If you're a denizen of Capitol Hill, if you're a Washington inside junkie, then you know that there is no day around the Hill where one of the telecoms isn't holding a fundraiser for somebody. It's just part of the social schedule of Washington. And of course, we get all the facts we need about what the telecoms liberalization process did in Western Europe by looking at the relationships between the newly liberalized telecoms and the state. The Indian example is a little different. It consists not of suitcases full of money being brought to Red Fort as in the old days of the bad UPA government, but the new, better, improved BJP government in which suitcases of cash do not need to be given to the prime minister's office, the benefits are intangible and consist of electoral control. I don't mean control, it works badly sometimes, but 80,000 fully encrypted WhatsApp channels in Karnataka can indeed make a difference to electoral outcomes. So if we ask then, what is government's relationship to the physiology of this net, the net we do not want, the one that uses the private privacy invasion subcontractors to collect tons of information and make it available in cleaned ways, right? You could think of this as behavioral data laundering, couldn't you? The relationship that has been built up at that corner of the net, the pipe corner, the place where all the pipes are controlled, the physiology of that has been based upon the idea that what government's interest is to see that telecommunications services are provided, that telecommunications services are expensive, that the private taxation system, which consists of charging for communications, is sufficiently closely tied to government to provide money to government, and access for those who wish to know, which, as I pointed out in the first Snowden lecture, stretches back to the Emperor Augustus and the way that the large Roman Empire structured itself with its post roads and its king's eyes and its listeners and its power to centralize information across the entire Mediterranean world, which is, of course, the model of the Pax Americana, the listening to everybody everywhere version of imperial aggression. I think that's a fair word, imperial aggression in the world after 1945. So let's just stop there for a moment. What does attacking the telecoms mean? What must government do if it cherishes people's rights that is different from what it now does with the anatomy of the network? What the basic American regulatory theory was after the Telecoms Act of 1996, what successive heads of the Federal Communications Commission, Republican and Democrat, considered to be significant, was the question, are the telecoms common carriers? Are they transporters of packets? Or are they offerers of services beyond the movement of the packets? And the industrial structure which flowed from the answer to that question was the industrial structure that all of the FCC chairs, whether Michael Powell or Reed Hunt or Turner, What the basic industrial structure that came to be thought of as acceptable in the post 96 United States is the people will not tolerate monopoly, but they are intensely relaxed about duopoly, so long as those duopolies can be said to be on converging courses that will bring them into competition with one another. As there is convergence, the big word of the 1990s, about this architecture. So it is okay if telephony is basically Verizon and AT&T, and it is okay if radio is basically Rupert Murdoch and Westward One, and so that each of the various elements of the telecommunications and public communications environment of the society consisted of powerful duopolies said to be drifting into competition with one another. Those of you who have chosen to write about Spotify, a thing which I understand exists and people have relationships with for reasons I can't quite grasp at all, those of you who write about Spotify are, of course, writing about a monopoly, in fact, arising out of the collapse of a duopoly which used to be called radio, and which is joined to a little oligopoly that used to be called popular music, and which now embraces a spoken word recording structure you call podcasts. But fundamentally, after all, what has happened is that the state has decided that it no longer has any concern over how the successor to radio broadcasting works, how the music industry works, how, for that matter, the spoken word exists free of the public interest regulations that used to apply to radio broadcasters. Here, what the state has done is to claim that it has no responsibility because no longer is it a matter of radio broadcasting within the forms of technology regulated by the 1933 and 34 Acts, etc., etc., all of which really amounts to we don't care. What would happen if we did? Well, of course, once upon a time, when I was a child, the government cared a lot about payola in radio and how popular music was promoted and all the various forms of corruption that were involved in that side of the... It even brought antitrust. But, of course, that's all gone. And this is a weird characteristic of the technology design determinism, which now affects the kind of public policy making that we're discussing. If you are Brussels, of course, it's even worse because you have no fucking Spotify. You can't even begin to imagine how you would create one. You are purely the captive to an imperial structure in the order of culture created by the Americans and wished on you, and then all you're allowed to do is mumble about data protection. This, in societies in which they used to own the radio broadcasting structures, and if it wasn't on Deutsche Welle, where was it? So we might begin just there in the middle to ask, what would happen if we escaped all of the various ways in which the telecommunications intermediaries are treated as something other than wholesalers moving our packets around, common carriers like all the people who put bags on wagons in the history of the human economy. It's true that the Wheeler FCC, at the very leftist end of this consensus in the Obama administration, was prepared under the guise of that ridiculous phrase network neutrality, actually to treat the telecommunications network operators as common carriers who simply had to set rates for carrying packets from point A to point B and could not privilege their own packets or sell services on top of them. But as you are aware, only a Democratic administration in total control of Congress, actually in total control of Congress, and possessing a working majority in the United States Senate, can even conceive of such a regulatory approach. No other FCC could possibly do it, and no FCC is likely to in the near future. But we can imagine. Let's just think about phone service. At the end of the 20th century, businesses used things called private branch exchanges, PBX, right? The collapse of the true AT&T monopoly took with it Western Electric, the primary manufacturer of telecoms hardware in the United States, and prevented the networks, all of the post-breakup AT&T networks, from controlling what telephone endpoints were attached to the network. Once that happened, hardware began to establish itself, made by private parties like Rome around here or Avaya or lots of others, providing digital telephony services to be attached to the traditional POTS networks, the plain old telecommunication services networks. And businesses, law firms, of course, we're always interested in law firms and everybody else too, began to operate PBXs, which meant that a trunk line entered their premises physically, and they then divided that into all of the pots and pans of the handset, of the desk sets, and the other forms of telecommunications machinery attached to their lines. And they operated the extensions and allocated them and provided voicemail and all, all that stuff. Using hardware that was manufactured by some enterprise using increasingly non-US low-wage labor to produce physical objects that replaced expensive AT&T telephony with more capable, lower cost, but similarly structured telephony in the world of the late 80s, 90s into this century. It's not really very good, but it's okay, and it would really be better if you didn't need all that hardware, which you don't. It is not hard to make a telephone company in the sense that we ordinarily speak of one. And it's not hard to do that without special purpose equipment. My law practice has existed now for more than 16 years. It has never had telephones in that sense. Why should it? We have a piece of free software called Asterisk. Asterisk enables any general purpose computer to become a telephone private branch exchange. All the things that all that hardware did can now be done simply in software in any not even large box. If you really wanted to have a home telephone service consisting of six or seven people talking on things, possibly at once, we could run Asterisk in a Raspberry Pi, and that would be the end of it. So what do we mean by a telephone company? Of course, there are all those other telephones in the world, mobiles and fixed telephony, and they exist on other continents and other countries with other tariff systems. But if I am a private branch exchange of my own, that is to say, if I am running Asterisk, it is easy enough for me to go and buy from a bulk transporter the innards of digital telephony. Let us say I pick a supplier at random, Junction Networks, one of the ones that I have used for the past decade and a half. Junction Networks will enable me from the box in my apartment or the box in a closet in an office space to ring any telephone on earth. It will allow any telephone on earth to ring me. That is to say, it will deliver the call to that PBX where Asterisk will then begin to figure out whose laptop to address and so on. It will interface in a seamless manner with the mobile telephony networks and all their horribleness and so on. What does that mean? Well, that means if someone dials my law firm telephone number, 212-461-1901, I have designated some instrument somewhere in the world sitting on some desktop to be where it should ring, it will ring there. If it doesn't ring there, it will find my laptop if it is anywhere on the internet in the world and deliver the call to software in the laptop. If there's no laptop of mine anywhere on the network, it will ring a mobile telephone number, the one I have said I want it to ring, for as many seconds as I want it to ring. And if it doesn't get answered, then it will bring the call back to some voicemail sitting on that same PBX box, and you'll leave a message, and then an SMS will be generated and sent to whatever telephone I want it to be that will say, so-and-so just left you such and such number of seconds of voicemail, you might want to get around to it, etc., etc. In other words, all the various forms of service that you might want from telephony produced for you or for some combination of people you consider to be you, with no more than a commodity interaction with any other telephone system in the world, nobody offering over-the-top services, nobody allowed to intercept or change the nature of calls. All of it's simply a common carrier over here and the user of telephony over there. Needless to say, if I am located at the moment that that call occurs inside the territory of the People's Republic of China, I will be very glad that this is the way my telephone system works. Because everything will be so strongly encrypted that even the second best team in the world will have trouble dealing with it. Encrypting such telephone calls is child's play. Right? It's not even in the PBX. It's in the virtual private network, in the true sense of VPN that I was describing last week, which connects us all to our office network, right, to our combined business. If my law partner is located in some difficult spot, like, say, Delhi, or for that matter, Moscow, and if we want to have a call between the two of us, it will be as tough to break as it would be if we were talking over the NATO voice encryption system called Fortezza, and apparently much better than if we are talking over the Russian military command and control encrypted communication system called ERA, which has failed on the battlefield in Ukraine, as you know, and cost the life of at least 7 Russian generals, which is really pretty bad comms. Pretty good comms, better than pretty good comms, in other words, are available in order to do that work. Pricing. Well, basically the answer, of course, is dirt cheap. By which I don't mean dirt cheap for a single point-to-point so-called long-distance call within a country. That's small beer. The telecoms operators give that away to you. I mean, let us suppose that I have a one-hour, 50-party conference call with endpoints in 16 or 20 countries. What will it cost me to run that hour and a half call? Well, I don't know exactly because we haven't figured out which countries and in particular how many of the participants in that conference are on mobile devices because foreign calls coming into mobile systems are always made to pay enormous non-competitive prices just to reach the mobile phone. But my experience over the course of all these years with doing large international meetings of that kind is that I can assume that for such a, you know, 50 people for an hour and a half across many national boundaries, if I wind up paying more than $20 for the call, I'm going to be surprised. In general, an order of magnitude smaller than the costs that most businesses pay to conduct that kind of telephone meeting across their various national boundaries. Because there's still that much air in the system. What is government's interest? That a telephone system exists? That it makes enough money to produce good political donations? Or that the people of the society have, in this sense, freedom of expression. That to organize telephony across boundaries is the right of everybody, and that anybody can do it, and that the price which they have to pay is one that the people can afford. You might think of that as a government responsibility. It will be hard to make that a positive responsibility of the First Amendment, however. So the question is, what about you? You remember that this is essentially how WhatsApp came to be the globe-spanning phenomenon that it is. People getting cheap messaging and cheap voice communications and cheap grouping, because it was all a giveaway in return for being able to spy on you. That tells you both how much surplus there is in the system and how easy it was for private power to offer truly lousy services at truly amazing prices, leaving plenty of room for government to get both money and secrecy penetration out of it. But imagine once you stop. So again, all I want to say is the cheapest of computers with software that costs nothing, and it's easy for you to build a telephone company and put it in your apartment or your garage or anywhere you have both a static internet connection and some electricity, and then offer the service to anybody you like. Give them a telephone number and let people call it. Let them call anywhere. Let them do anything. You can have free voice communications, including video communications, with any party in the world if you want to, even without setting up any intermediate point, because organizations like SIP2SIP will be happy to give you the ability to manage such calls for nothing. The Brave browser at the moment will let you do any amount of point-to-point video communication browser-to-browser without any intermediate. But nowhere does government say this is part of our fundamental regulatory plan. We plan to move to forms of voice communication which are costless and surveillance resistant and appropriately in the control of ordinary people who may federate the systems as they want, set everything up. Not merely that we will permit this, but that we will functionally support this. If a government takes that position, within a decade, the large telecommunication structures within its territory will have changed. In the same way that a government that prefers onshore wind to nuclear power will change the way electricity is generated within its boundaries. But that decision is said to be an ordinary one of government, engaged in all the time, and if the British Parliament wants to do a stupid thing or the American Congress wants to do a smart one, nobody will be terribly surprised. With respect to ending the bottlenecking of the telecommunications operators, however, everybody would be surprised if any government played a straight game. And now we are just talking about that fulcrum in the middle, that place where the anatomy of the network concentrates. We haven't yet begun to talk about the physiology, the functionality of the network. No, I'm going to. Similarly, of course, as I tried to suggest yesterday, the thing we call the cloud, a particular pattern of technology, workloads may move through the computers in the network freely and frictionlessly. I have a program running here on a box in Germany. I can move that program while it is running to a box in South Africa, and the program will not know that it has changed. I can smoothly move all the workloads involved in giving people dumbass microblogging or stupid photo sharing or all these other brain dead applications. I can move those around from place to place and slide them from server farm to server farm. Iceland is cheap today. Quebec will be cheap tomorrow. All of that can be done, and we do it in the cloud now, by moving workloads to high concentrations of privately owned computers owned by platform companies located where cheap electricity is available. That's the current design structure of the net, the thing we call the cloud, a particular way of using low friction ability to move workloads from place to place instantly. But we do not have to imagine the cloud made that way. Imagine instead that we turn the cloud inside out, as I was suggesting last week, and personal single-board computers capable of running all the same operating system software become the cloud made out of droplets, where droplets are little things that cost a few dozen dollars, that don't require vast amounts of electricity for each one to operate. I mean, I have friends who make small computers designed to be put aboard self-launched satellites. I'm not going to talk about self-launched satellites right here, but they design the tech for things you can put in orbit by yourself, and the computing that you can use to put things in orbit by yourself. And there we have server computers that actually do use single-digit nanowatts of power. We're talking about, you know, a tenth of a AA battery at peak consumption. Well, not a tenth, a hundredth of a AA battery at peak consumption. In other words, the amount of electricity required to provide the services we think we get from the cloud is tiny compared to the amount of power we actually put into the big private cloud, which moves where hydropower is cheap. Why is that true? Well, the most important reason is that all the surveillance and the analytics and the ad platforms and all the other stuff put on top of those trivial services are running in that form of concentrated cloud, and they are, from a power and resources, or physical resources point of view, very expensive. Once you begin to remove all of that from the way we provide services to ourselves, the way we get email, the way we do chat, the way we do video conferencing, once you begin to dissect out from the cloud we actually use for the front-end services that we as people think are important to us, once you dissect all that out from the back-end services that are merchandising you, it turns out that we don't need anywhere as much computing, and we don't need to move to Iceland in order to get cheap hydropower anymore. In fact, after all, people still light their houses using way more power than they would need to do all their computing and storage in their houses. So let us imagine then for a moment the government actually tries to decide what the cloud should be like. The government actually thinks, well, you know, it's true. There's lots of ways that you can move people around. You can have roads, and you can drive gasoline-powered cars on them, or you can drive electric-powered cars on them, or you can have trains and trams and other forms of mass transport. It would be very strange if any government, even the government of the United States, decided that it didn't care. It was totally indifferent how people moved around. That would seem truly peculiar to us, because we assume that how people move themselves around is one of the things that government has to care about, and it has to encourage the correct answers. There were a number of American protectorates in the world. Iceland and Israel are both good examples, in which car culture got generated because government just didn't pay any attention. Israeli government just actually didn't care if there were rail lines in the state. It was very strange that it didn't, but it didn't. I am among the only living human beings, I believe, who ever took a train from Tel Aviv to Haifa, because why would you do that? You get in your Land Rover and you sit in the increasing... And Iceland, too, a country right with essentially one road running around the periphery of an island made otherwise of impassable places, which was entirely car-dependent. There were a few Icelanders I knew over the years who actually took buses from place to place, but that was mostly regarded, as it was in the other society, as the, you know, the job of low-paying immigrant workers was to take buses. That indifference, when we think about it in the history of a society, marks the society as having made a fundamental mistake. The Icelanders woke up one day and smack their foreheads at the beginning of the 21st century and said, crap, we live on an island with unlimited free electrons, but we import gasoline to run our cars, and we're just dumb. And so, because the Icelanders had a ton of money at that time, they decided that they were going to have what came to be called in Iceland the 2015 Project. The 2015 project was a project to replace every internal combustion engine on the island. The Icelanders would move to electric transport, by 2015. And the mechanism of the process would be that everybody on Iceland who bought a plug-in hybrid car, none of which existed at the time that the plan was made, but the Icelanders assumed that the world economy would start to produce plug-in hybrids. Everybody on Iceland who bought a plug-in hybrid car before 2015 would get lifetime free electricity to power the car. This is why I first found myself meeting with the President of the Republic. Because if Iceland was going to have a system to provide free electricity to every plug-in hybrid car, the way it was going to do that was going to be to have smart chargers that could render to central accounting how much electricity went into an automobile battery and deduct that amount from the home heating costs of the party who owned the car. So everybody would get a rebate from their home heating costs, all electrical, of course, where they existed, and where they didn't heat their homes by electricity, because an awful lot of Icelandic homes are just heated by hot water coming out of the ground, then from their other electrical use. I wanted that to be a free software operating system for charging stations around the world that would be able to provide the free electricity to automobiles by deducting from home electricity cost system. And so what I wanted was for us to make a free software system in Iceland that we could then clone all over the world without having to pay for software technology to create an infrastructure for the social encouragement of hybrid automobiles and ultimately full electric vehicles. The Icelanders actually did all this, and then 2008 happened, their banks crashed, there was an enormous international payments crisis for the Icelanders, all the money evaporated, and the 2015 project never came into existence in 2015 in the intended sense. And the rest of the world, too, now has to figure out how to construct its charging stations and get its electric cars up and running and how to encourage that to occur, which is largely by tax breaks and other forms of indirect and inefficient government spending. Better to have decided how the technology should work and make it work on the basis that this is transport, and of course government needs to do that. Now we can ask about things like telecoms and the platforms the same questions. I'm trying to show how. Our position is government actually determines, not determines in the criminal sense or even determines in the competition law and antitrust sense, but merely determines through its constant role as a shaper and participant in the economy how technology design is conducted. We don't have Facebook, we make it. And we don't have a problem in unmaking it. We know what the technology is. But of course, if individuals are to be held responsible for the shaping of collective transport policy, they will not produce good railways. They'll buy cars and they'll drive them on roads. So what we are now trying in this sense to understand at each stage, from the endpoints to the telecommunications midpoints, to the platform storage companies, to the market for services and whether they are paid for at cost zero with behavior data or whether they're paid for at social cost by socialized infrastructures like drinking water in some countries or roads in some countries. In other words, where the line between what we are pleased to call socialism and what we are pleased to call capitalism exists in the social uses of our technology. I'm unable to consider it a major blow for free speech in the world that Elon Musk has used $3 billion extra dollars he found behind the couch cushions to buy 9% of Twitter and go on the board. It's pleasing Mr. Musk very much, I'm sure. And I'm sure his pot dealer and he are now even more connected on Twitter than they were before and will be later, and money will be made, and so on and so forth. But the real question is, haven't the societies of the world by now figured out that Twitter's not a good thing? And the answer is no, of course they haven't figured that out, because the two forms of activity in the society which are mostly, which are best enabled by the crap we call Twitter, is government and the press, which really like it. And who are we to say, yeah, but we the people of the United States, in order to have a more perfect union and domestic tranquility, would like you to shut Twitter up and replace it with something useful? That would violate free speech, particularly Mr. Musk's free speech, his investment-backed expectations in a definition of free speech. You can see how very constitutional all of that will be. And yet, there is another way of understanding the state's responsibility to its citizens. It's the form of responsibility which says, you know that toxic waste dump you put next to that elementary school? We really should shut it down. Because, of course, there is a toxic waste dump next to every school and every home and every human life, and we really should shut it down. Why don't we think we should? Why isn't that regarded as part of what it means for government not to abridge free speech and the press? Where is it written that the way of not doing that is to tolerate a more toxic form of the press than used to exist? Well, the answer, of course, is because people don't know how to express themselves without Twitter, which is a legitimate objection. But the remedy should not be to tolerate Twitter. The remedy should be to teach people how not to need it. And to say of government that the First Amendment doesn't provide that is probably true, though I really do want to argue hard about it. I want to see how many votes there are in the Supreme Court decade by decade for that outcome. But if I look at the New York State Constitution, which gives people a right to public education, and if principals believe that the devices are uncontrollable in their schools, then maybe we ought to ask, what does it mean to give people a right to a public education and then give them iReady and Google Classroom and Twitter? Did that actually solve the problem? You understand that Columbia Law School has absolutely no obligation to provide a good education to you, right? I mean, it's inconceivable that there is a rule anywhere that requires Columbia Law School to provide you a good education. That's not really supposed to be important. The market is supposed to take care of that, right? You're not supposed to come here and pay them a ton of money to be badly educated. I suppose that this is an instance of market failure. But it's not really an issue of market failure so much as it's an example of educational failure. My first-year students are in deep pain because as they were all, I mean, not every single last one of them, but everybody who was willing to say anything in the classroom, which is fewer people than it used to be, they were all stating to me in deep anger and bitterness yesterday that their other instructors have ceased making eye contact with them. Oh, our teachers are either always looking up or looking down, but never at us. And I made a joke. I said, yeah, well, you know how that is. That's the Zoom eye contact problem. And so they all reach for their tomatoes to throw it at me because I don't understand. I'm just making a joke out of how deeply offensive and personality reducing this is. But I actually really did know. I just find it hard to believe that my colleagues have been so poisoned by the way of teaching in the epidemic that they are learning how not to make eye contact with the people in the room. It's not the students who are failing here. The technology is failing to make teaching possible, though it was supposed to be the technology that allowed teaching to continue. But then, I mean, I never thought video conferencing would work for law school teaching, which is why I never used it and why I wrote the essay explaining why it wouldn't work before the epidemic began. It's not that it's hard to know. It's that you must approach the technology in a critical fashion, asking what it is good at, what it costs, what it's bad at, what the alternatives are, how it can be made to work. Do not expect the law school to do any of that anytime soon. It has satisfied itself that if once again something inexplicable happens and an epidemic occurs, Zoom will be just fine, thank you, at $15 a seat per student, per course. So what are our actual alternatives? The first and most important distinction lies over here in this platforms and storage place, the G and T and F of it. The question is, what are these services that these objects are providing? The email, the calendaring, the conferencing. These are services which in their nature are either centralized or federated. You're accustomed to being an endpoint. You receive a service. You send a request to a computer and say, show me what pending email I have, or show me what I'm doing on Wednesday, or find a time when I can have a call with Jack. And the question that arises in the delivery of that service is whether the service uses a single server or a bunch of cloudiness that reduces in concept to a single server, or whether the world consists of an uncertain number of arbitrarily defined servers owned by whoever, working by whoever, following the same rules that all other such services follow, in such a way that we federate the condition of that service. Let's start with services which are intended to be federated. Email is a good one. We have a set of rules. They're not actually rules. They're because the Internet Society and all the engineers who cooperate to produce these rules operate not by authority but by consensus, such that, as I have previously described to you here, every single protocol in the net is a document with a number in a class called RFC, that is Request for Consensus. RFCs issued by the Internet Engineering Task Force define how email works. That means they define what the headers on an email can be like and how they're punctuated and how individual mail transport agents should read the headers of email messages in order to decide where they are delivered and how to get them there, the consequence of which is that email is designed so that the number of servers in the world can be infinite and arbitrary, and every box which receives email can be on any particular server, and we can all offer email services of that kind to one another. That means that I can have a computer, maybe a tiny one that costs a few dozen dollars, and I can put an MTA in it, and I can put a webmail client like RoundCube in it, and I can simply say to you, okay, so you have an email box on my server right now. That's infinitely possible to do. Yet, Google succeeded in centralizing email. So that almost everybody in this room is in one way or another in contact with either a centralized Google email server or a server owned by Columbia University running Google software and existing as an artifact, a little piece of protoplasm separated from the mothership, but not by much. That centralization means if you want to attack email service, if you want to steal people's email, if you are, for example, the Chinese Ministry of State Security, you don't have to penetrate 100 million servers, you just have to get inside Gmail. It also means, of course, that everybody's email is being read by Google. I don't know. That's probably not so good. Maybe. I have, of course, the ability to make email servers. I'm like everybody else, at least in the sense of if you know how. The software is all free. I don't have to get anybody's permission to use it. I don't have to pay for it. It will work on any hardware. It's the problem of setting it up is trivial. You get yourself a fully qualified domain name so that your people know where to send the mail to the relevant boxes, and you're done. I have an offer for you, in fact. You need a new email box, right? I would suggest kgbmail.net. I actually own that. I'll give you a mailbox there. I'll give you an infinite-sized mailbox. I'll even let you sort it as well as search it. I'll go past Gmail. I'll give you $100 for signing up, and I'll read all your mail forever. You want the deal? That's weird, because Google doesn't even give you the $100. Right? Centralized services are a problem. Federated services produce answers, but we don't use them even when the service is inherently federated by design. Because it's so convenient. And therefore, we institutionalize the idea that you shouldn't have any privacy in email. It's not merely that the fact that somebody might be running kgbmail.net is not a problem. It's that somebody is running kgbmail.net, and it's Google. And we complain all the time about Google this and Google that, and Lena does a terrific job making the FTC appear to be a threatening entity, and blah, 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 blah. But the thing is technologically made to escape all of this, and still it's not happening. That's a teaching problem. Now, of course, I have to assume as a teacher that if I begin by teaching you how to set up an email server, you won't do it. And everybody will remain in stasis waiting for somebody else to take the first move. So the first thing I ought to do would be to say, well, if everybody's going to allow KGB mail to be the universal structure, we sure damn well better start to figure out how to encrypt all our email for ourselves. Because if the infrastructure that society is going to decide we ought to have is an infrastructure which presumes the inability to keep our own conversation secret, then we better restore our ability to make our conversation secret. That would be technical exercise one. How to use PGP/GPG, how to generate keys, how to integrate with Gmail, probably something terrible ought to be done also for the prisoners of the King of the Undead, now dead. But most importantly, how to teach other people. Right? Because there isn't any point actually structuring the text so well. I mean, there is some point. I can tell Adam Tanner that I would do it. But more importantly, what you need is the ability to proliferate the technology design throughout the part of society that's relevant to you. We haven't then refederated email. But we have done two other useful things. We have figured out how to teach people how to keep their email private at their endpoints. Though I would never allow in my law practice GPG keys to be put in mobile telephones, because it's too easy to steal them from the smart-ass phones of the people, thanks to our friends at NSO and similar. So our endpoints remain corrupted. We haven't changed that. But we have, at any rate, created an environment in which people both understand why federation of email would be a good deal and what to do with it until that time comes, or even after that time comes. Naturally, of course, you could just go to Proton Mail and they'll teach you some of this, and as long as you remain at Proton Mail, everything will be fine, blah, blah, blah. But it would really be better if we taught people how to fish. We should, similarly, always have the option to move our browsing to some other location in the world. It ought to be no trouble at all to say, forget I'm over here, pretend I'm over there. Give me the benefits of being wherever over there is, like I'm outside the Great Firewall, or I'm in a place where people won't pull out my fingernails for saying there's a war going on in Ukraine, or whatever it is. That should be technical exercise number two, how to move your browsing securely from where you actually are to someplace else where it would be better if you were. I can't do that with you in the sense of set it up and try it and prove to me you understand how it works, because the Columbia facilities for doing that have been destroyed. Instead, I can say, here's how you would do it if you wanted to for $10 a month instead of the VPN provider who is ratting you out. But what we really ought to have is a world in which Columbia regards it as necessary to provide safe browsing to the people who live and work there, and New York City feels that it needs to provide safe browsing to the people who live here. We do have working socialism in public health in New York City. I don't know whether you have received even one booster vaccination yet. Soon you will need a second, then you will need a third, then you will need a fourth. You will be glad to know that in New York City, every inhabitant of New York City, not every citizen, not every anything, just every inhabitant of New York City is entitled to receive at no cost such vaccinations in your home by request. You didn't know that because socialism doesn't advertise itself that way, but that is your right. That is how I have my first booster in my home just before Christmas. I called New York City's public health line on a Thursday and I said, I want a booster. And they said, when would you like? And I said, how about next Wednesday? And they said, fine. And two lovely public health workers called me from the car on the way over and came and gave me my vaccination and went away again. I admire New York City for doing that. You should admire New York City for doing that too. Even if you don't use the service, which you are entitled to do because you live here, I'm sure you will admire New York City for doing that. It's much better than locking down a city of 26 million people and taking children away involuntarily to quarantine sites and so on. But why is that possible and city-encouraged safe browsing is not possible? You do not actually think it costs more to provide safe browsing proxies for everybody in New York City than to provide them with in-home vaccinations by two-person public health teams. Of course, it's true we're not really spending all that money because most people aren't going to ask, and the people who are going to ask are going to be medically frail people who would know that the system exists because they interact with the public health system all the time that tells them it exists, and it's certainly not going to be poor people who have to go to work at risk of their lives and would really like to get vaccinated at home because they won't know because society won't tell them. Which is sort of why they're also using smart-ass phones that spy on them, using terribly expensive data plans that cap what they can learn and restrict their ability to communicate outward as opposed to inward and all the other things, because we don't say the people have rights, and the job of government is to make those rights more effective. Federating all services would be a really good start. My dear friend and colleague Conrad Johnson has called a meeting of the IT committee for Friday, the 19th of April. It is marked on my calendar because it is the only time in the month of April that I will use Zoom. I can think of no other thing that could be going on at Columbia University in which I would be willing to use Zoom. But out of respect for Conrad and the way he runs the IT committee, I will show up on Zoom. That will be the second time that I have used Zoom during the entire epidemic, and it will be the third time I have tried to use Zoom during the epidemic, because I tried to go to Comrade's IT committee meeting in the fall semester, and suddenly a power failure in my apartment knocked out all my computers and I couldn't go to the meeting. Three times I would have used Zoom, therefore, right? The other one was the speech at IIT Bombay I was talking about 2 weeks ago. Three total uses. It's true that I don't like commodity video conferencing. I think it stinks. I've thought it stunk since I started using it in the late 20th century. But that's not the reason I don't use Zoom. The reason I'm not compelled to use Zoom. The reason I'm not compelled to use Zoom is I can always say, let's do it on my server. And if people say, no, we won't do it on your server, I can always say, then I have tenure and goodbye. Think of all the people for whom neither of those two answers are available. That not having tenure part, that's serious. That's really bad. Employment at will sucks, and most people in this society are afraid of being fired all the time, and they can't even conceive of what it would be like to be able to say, you can't fire me, go away. And I admit that I have no technical solution to that problem. But the other problem, I don't have a video conference server of my own. That's really easy. Really, really easy. Who here has needed to be the host of a more than dozen person video conference recently? Okay. So that's large family size? That's business. Large family size might be a reason, but that's okay. Because all I'm really asking is, do you need more than a Raspberry Pi to run your video conference server? The one that I used for all the things that I needed, office hours and small group meetings, and back in the beginning of this semester when, as you recall, we were suddenly 1 week remote and I had to meet my first year class, not you fortunately, but them, by remote conference. The one... simple piece of gear I need, my video conference server, meet.moglen.us, is a tiny little piece of software running in a virtual machine upstairs that I physically constrain to be no larger than a Raspberry Pi. I physically make that virtual machine starved of memory. I don't let it have any disk to write on. It doesn't have a place to store a copy of the video conference, even if it wanted to. There's no storage there to write on. And I use it in its disabled form because that is the form in which it could be federated throughout society on little simple boxes. You are supposed to believe that Zoom is fancy technology, and if it weren't for Zoom, you couldn't have it. That's another centralization of an inherently federated server. When you federate a service, you probably improve it. You certainly change its design. The software that I am using for meet.moglen.us, Jitsi Meet, is designed to be a federated service. Zoom does this thing which commercial things tend to do with their software. Zoom is trying to give you a uniform user experience. That means it works badly everywhere, all the time, in the same ways, but that's not what they think. They think that once you have downloaded the app and and are running mysterious software you don't know anything about and they don't really know anything about either on your computer, then every conference experience will be just about the same. You know how well this works because you know how often that is not the case, but that's the technical desire. The result is that Zoom runs its software in a highly centralized way. Centralized for the benefit of the Chinese Ministry of State Security, of course, by running data through Chinese servers, but not only. Centralized in the sense that the assumption is that the experience of the conference, whether it is going fast or slow, whether you've got glitches, whether uncanny valley representations of human beings are occurring, or crap like that, is all decided at the central server side. That's the effective team-up, let us say, between Oracle and Zoom. We, Oracle, Larry Ellison, the great himself, will run Zoom software in the United States and give it to NSA instead of the Ministry of State Security, and everybody will get a uniform experience. Jitsi Meet works the other way. All the computing that the video conference system needs, wherever possible, is put in JavaScript and downloaded to the browsers of the endpoint. That means that what your endpoint computer is matters more than it does if you are using Zoom. More computing power in that laptop, a little more main storage in that laptop, will produce a better relationship to the conference streams. But the result of doing that computing in the endpoints is that the server in the center can be smaller and weaker because it doesn't have to do as much work. Hence, I can run in a Raspberry Pi a dozen-person conference, and it will be fine because the computers of the people connecting to the conference will be doing more of the work. That process of sharing out is antithetical to the desire to maintain distributive control. That's why software which works that way is more likely to be free software made by a community than commercial software made by people trying to make a profit. Generally, therefore, what happens when we federate services is that by the process of trying to allow anybody to set up a server and serve whoever they want to, we're going to change the way the software functions in order to make sharing better. To how many people in the room is the word BitTorrent familiar? Yeah, well, good. I mean, you know, media sophisticates. So what really is happening in this thing we call BitTorrent? Let's say you want to distribute software and your Microsoft. Your fundamental goal in life will be to have everybody get the software from you. You'll want them to get it off your server. You'll want them to have to register with you. You'll want to keep track of them. And therefore, your distribution structure will look like this, right? Everybody will get something from you, and you will serve all those people one at a time or 10,000 at a time, depending upon how much expense you're willing to undertake. But there's another part of it. You will need a ton of bandwidth. Because every bit that moves only one way, from you to them. That's a centralized structure for file distribution, for software distribution in particular. And it has the usual problem of centralized services. It concentrates too much power in the guy at the top. That's why he likes it, because he is the guy at the top. BitTorrent is an invention, not a service, really. It's an invention of a guy, a hacker, Bram Cohen. Just another person like you or me who happens to want to solve a problem as an itch. A BitTorrent approach to the distribution of anything, let's call it software because it very often is this. There are some people who have a full copy of the CD image, the ISO, the zip file, the whatever, and let us call them seeds. And And now what's going to happen is that people are going to want a copy of that file. It works best if the file's very large for reasons you'll see in a minute, like a CD image or a DVD or a movie or whatever. People are going to request that file. They're going to be called leechers. But the file that they are receiving is going to be broken up into a lot of separate pieces. And the minute that each of them starts downloading, he's going to start sharing with every other leecher. That's why it's called a BitTorrent, because it develops like a hurricane, like a tornado, like a typhoon. It's a cycle. And everybody is sharing as they are downloading, and if L4 shows up, L2 and L1 and S3 are all going to decide to provide some pieces. So at any given moment, the person engaged in the distribution has only some of the pieces of the file and is getting them from all the other people. And after a while, they have a totally complete version, and they can become seeds themselves and simply distribute pieces of the file to other people who will keep the torrent running. And as long as there are people who want to receive the file, there will be a torrent. Now here, as you see, the bandwidth of each of the seeds is not really important anymore. Everybody's sharing the job of moving those buckets around. The result is that we can distribute to more people more rapidly using decentralized bandwidth at much lower cost. This will be really good for movies. So it is. This will be really good for TV series, so it's used that way. Therefore, BitTorrent is hated by the Hollywoods of the world, the Bollywoods of the world, too. Indeed, all the owners of culture, because sharing is wrong. But if what we're distributing is free software, in which the property in the content has been released for sharing to everybody, then there's no downside, there's only pure upside. We're just doing it better. We are federating the job of moving things around instead of centralizing that same job. The transport network is efficiently used instead of inefficiently used. Costs go down. Everybody is better off except the guy, Microsoft, Disney Plus, whoever it was, who was previously using an inefficient, capital-intensive structure of distribution precisely because capital-intensiveness and inefficiency is part of the business model of not letting people have things unless they pay. Here what has happened is not that technology design has been co-opted. It's that a political economy design determines a technological design, and people don't know that something else is possible, although there are a couple of people in this room who do, presumably because waiting for Hollywood to send you a thing on your streaming subscription at Disney Plus is a way less good opportunity than simply saying, you know what, I think I'd like to watch Passing. Why don't I just go and get it off the torrent? Because I am not a popular culture aware, well-cultured, popular cultured person, I often find out from other people about things I ought to watch or listen to. And I usually find that by the time somebody has finished telling me what it is, the torrent is already delivering it to me. And I don't have to worry about, has it left Netflix? Or did Joni Mitchell remove it from Spotify? Well, we'll come back to music because that's another whole story. Music is small, comparatively speaking. Here we are really talking about all that culture, which is heavy. You know. But what we're really talking about is the very way in which we use the net to create files and move them around is determined by an implicit understanding of the ideal political economy. And we don't know that our technology inbuilds that idea about the political economy because we think that's the way file distribution works. Unless you're a little clever, the way Bram was, you won't invent this. And if you're not more clever than Bram because you're not working on the problem, you won't imagine that there is a solution. And so another future will not be possible. But let us say that I have a village in Telangana, a little thing, you know, a 50,000-person village. And I have Swecha, and I have Freedom Box. And so some Swecha people go out into the village, and they put up a pole. And on the top of the pole is a Freedom Box and a solar cell. And now the little computer is being run off Sunshine, and it's connected to the net at the one place in the village where the connection to the wired net that belongs to either the public telecoms or the private telecoms is. And I put a BitTorrent daemon using the program I call Transmission, which is just one of our BitTorrent tools. I put a transmission daemon up there at the top of that pole. Freedom Box automatically includes a transmission daemon, so I don't have to install any software. And then I'm a television station for those 50,000 people. Anybody who wants to request video can. Anybody who wants to watch video that somebody else in the village has already watched can. And the transmission daemon is sitting there up on the top of the pole using BitTorrent to use mostly other people's bandwidth to collect and distribute everything that everybody wants to watch. Much in the same way that Asterisk could have provided a telephone system to the village, or a Freedom Box running an email server could have provided email to the village. The direction of social travel of the technology is not determined by the technology. But the technology and the direction of social travel, the policy level in the management of the village or the state or the country, ultimately determines what people think can be done. And that which people do not think can be done can't be done. There's a very Confucian proposition for you. Right? Well, and of course, the Chinese Communist Party is the world's greatest student of this proposition. Tsar Vladimir is a mere, you know, I mean, he's a rookie. He just thinks that you can make people say it's not a war by calling it a special military operation. Here, what we have is entire structures of technology that become not available because nobody knows that they exist or imagines how they can be used. Antonio Gramsci had a word for this. This is hegemony in function, right? Questions have been erased from the social world. We don't ask about these things. They're not political because they don't exist. If the questions don't exist, then there are no answers other than the one that replaced the questions. Throughout our technological environment, throughout the net of the present, you experience this hegemonic structure. It's not merely convenience, right? We've talked a little bit about convenience, and we have some more yet to do. Remember, it is really convenient when stuff is cheap. Amazon and Chimerica were constructed around the idea that cheap stuff that just arrives is convenient. That this has some effect on the labor force delivering the goods has recently been in the news again. Maybe people who live in Staten Island and work at Amazon warehouses would prefer that there were some alternatives to piecing in the bottles or being motion studied all the time and all the rest of the labor management horrors. But it's more than just that, after all. The network embodies a set of principles about what will be true. The convenience is also the absence of choice. We didn't used to think in American capitalism that that was an important element. On the contrary, we celebrated the excess of choice. How many brands of washing powder do we need to have? How many brands of Wonder Bread-like stuff do we need? As many as possible. Because the ideology of consumer choice met the industrial structure of society very well. It's a solution to the problem that Marx thought of as the surplus value problem and that Lenin thought of as the root of imperialism. You make too much stuff, you have to find a place to put it, so you conquer countries and make them buy it. And that was indeed the primary political economy problem of industrial civilization: excess stuff, surplus value. But that's not the primary problem of rights in the digital society. The problem isn't surplus value. The problem is a desire for absence of choice. On the one hand, from the oligopolists of its delivery, and on the other hand, on the part of people who are afraid of technology and who think that less choice is more convenient than more choice, because more choice means more stuff you have to know and more shit that could go wrong, and why can't I just buy it and turn it on and it will just work, which is the fundamental position of the king of the undead, now dead's empire. Apple stuff was the stuff that offered you no choice, but boy, was it beautiful, and it was so convenient because it just works. And on those perfectly understandable principles, the king of the undead, now dead, built a cult. The Microsoft version of this was the other way around. Windows also was based upon the fear of technology. But Windows was based upon the fear of the technology in the hope that if you delivered people really shitty software that didn't work, they would be less afraid of it, which is what happened. Windows became the butt of jokes, the blue screen of death, all that work lost all the time, all that crap, all those computers that couldn't run for more than 49 days without crashing, blah, blah, blah. But it made people feel better because it proved that computers weren't really all that threatening. They were just fancy, expensive junk you had to use. And that, too, produced not a cult, but a culture. And that culture provided itself with centralized software services that made power for the party at the center. And it was destroyed not by the antitrust authorities of the world, but by the anarchists who said, why don't we just give away better software than your shit? Why don't we just do it right and let everybody use it? Why don't we just make servers that don't die? It used to be that if you ran Microsoft's view of email, you had Exchange servers. And Exchange servers required a lot of, well, useless human effort to keep them running. So that Microsoft's position officially at the start of the 21st century was that you should have one Exchange server for every 100 people receiving email. And you should have full-time support personnel, one person for every 20 Exchange servers. You can understand if you ran a company of 400,000 people, that was a lot of money for the software, a lot of money for the hardware, a lot of money for the people, and a lot of really terrible email service, which people complained about all the time. But that's the way corporate email works. Naturally, it turned out it was a whole lot easier to run a Linux server and put a webmail client on it and serve 1,000 people, and the server would never go down, and you could have one person running 50 of them. That was why, in the end, it turned out to be really important to adopt free software around the industry in the United States, because look at all the people you could find. The political economy, in other words, didn't determine the technology, but the technology had the political economy built in, either theirs or ours. Part of why this seems to me the way it does, part of why I come here to talk about this stuff with people who are, after all, lawyers, why should they care, is that I know exactly how many possibilities would not just have disappeared as inconvenient, but would have disappeared as impossible to exist if we hadn't simply insisted upon making them and giving them away. And the reason we could do that is that there's a lot more brain power in the world than there are people with jobs at Microsoft. Mr. Gates famously said when he was standing up Infosys and making Murthy the second richest man in India and making his daughter the richest wife that any chancellor of the exchequer of the United Kingdom has ever had. When all of that was going on, when Infosys was being made as a little mini Microsoft, Mr. Gates famously said, software is an IQ business. And he, of course, was right about that. But IQ is federated. The human mind begins free. So the question is, where does government actually wind up in the process of freeing minds? Does it consider the freeing of the minds and the creation of technological alternatives that support people's rights and that equalize differences in wealth and power to be, well, a kind of nice thing to have if you could get it, but we really like dealing with Facebook? Or do they conclude that that's part of what it means to have a duty to advance the public welfare? That if you make rights, your job is to encourage people to use them and to protect them. If you think that, then at what point do you put what kind of government thumb on the scale? Should software sold in interstate commerce be distributed by BitTorrent? Well, maybe that goes too far, but maybe it doesn't, and maybe we should worry about that, and maybe we shouldn't. If you have a fitness bracelet, where should it leave the data? With you? With the company? With Google that bought the company that made the fitness bracelet? You have you maybe seen some of the excellent public seismology data that we now get from California? An earthquake occurs at 2:00 in the morning and the fitness bracelet knows how many people woke up and how long they stayed awake before they went to sleep. It's good data. I mean, if you're interested in earthquake safety and public communications and the effect of earthquakes on sleep patterns and public health, it's excellent data. But is it really a good idea for all those wristbands to be telling Google who woke up in the middle of the night and how long they stayed awake? Well, it must be, because Nest and Google checks how many times you flushed the toilet and who moved up the thermostat in the middle of the night because she felt cold, and when did he get up and turn it back down again because he didn't feel cold, and all those wonderful facts about human beings. But seriously, the technology design should be like that? Is that the way public health should work? Is that the way physical education should work? Is that the way wellness should be treated in the society? Those are political questions. But if they are subsumed in, well, it's so convenient, I bought a Fitbit and now I'm very fit, or at least bit, then those questions do not arise. They are lost behind the scheme of, well, it's so convenient for technology to work this way. We're in business. The business of America is data business, as one of you pointed out in a draft. Compare this just for a moment to the burning of the planet. Suppose a government's position is we're really kind of indifferent about whether the planet burns after we are out of office. Now, we take money from coal companies, and there's a coal baron in the Senate casting the deciding vote, and we really have been using the petroleum companies to project American power throughout the world since the moment after Stalingrad. And so we have a political stake. And we don't think that political stake is that it's up to us to prevent the world from burning. But if people get really mad about it and they vote us out and somebody else in, maybe the somebody else will feel like it's important. I believe you are aware that we've passed that point now. I believe you're aware that we can't go back there. It's not just that all those governments just signed off on the third part of the IPCC report. Now it's they who have signed on the line about what has to be done to keep the planet from heating up 3 degrees C and burning to pieces. That's true, however, but that's more of a sign of the outcome than it is a cause. The real cause is that the human race has sort of decided, kind of, that any government that behaves that way is being irresponsible. And that a result, which is hardly an overwhelming vote of confidence for saving the planet, is going to change the political economy of all the world's major societies. It would be no more complicated in that sense and a whole lot easier from an implementation point of view for the governments of the planet to decide that saving the privacy and the dignity of individual human life is a public interest. And that what they can do, never mind what they could do with infinite money, never mind what they could do if they were kings of the world, never mind that what they could do if democracy weren't so messy, but what they can actually do, what they can actually afford, what they can actually undertake, what they could actually execute is far easier in this world, where what we are trying to do is to save privacy and the dignity of human beings from the constant, unremitting surveillance of everything. That's not very hard. And then, of course, there is your laptop. I don't want to say your smartphone is completely fucking useless and damaging and you should drop it in the nearest wastebasket, because I've said that before and nobody came back. So I won't say that. I will say your laptop is an engine of freedom. I will say your laptop, unlike that smartphone, does not assume a political economy. It wasn't built at a time in which the political, or rather it wasn't designed at a time when the political economy determined the technological relationship you have to the things around you against you. Yes, it is true. If it's a Lenovo ThinkPad instead of an IBM ThinkPad, there are likely some little things in there that are not meant to help you. But mostly we can dispose of them once we have control over what software runs there. Technical exercise number three should be how to liberate the laptop. It shouldn't be too hard. I mean, of course, the king of the undead now dead has been at the factory, and he's screwed you in some of his models in unfortunate ways. And yes, Windows 8 began a process by which Microsoft tried to hobble hardware so it wouldn't run other software in the Windows object. I don't know if you've ever seen a Microsoft Surface device with its cover removed. Microsoft pioneered new effort in making Surface devices, because after the devices were constructed, one of the last things done on the production line was to fill them full of glue. I'm being serious about this, okay? Then pumping in adhesive material that would harden inside the case in such a way that, of course, nobody could change any of the components in it. They became unrepairable devices. That was good, because they're Windows boxes, and they should be like that. But most of your hardware is not like that. So technical exercise 3 and 4 and 5, if we're really going to go that route, is about all the different ways in which you can run stuff in that laptop that isn't the OS X or the Windows that, or even the Android that it started out with, but rather a collection of other software that might be good for you. Do you want a computer that only talks through Tor and that tries to produce anonymity on the net? Well, good, Tails is there. And you don't have to build a separate computer for it. You plug a USB key into the thing, you reboot it, and poof, your Tails. And Tails is designed so that when you stop running Tails, there will be nothing left in that computer that shows that it was there or anything you did with it. That's what the amnesiac A in Tails represents. So I need to show you how to boot Tails on your laptop. And then maybe you want something else that's right, you know. One of the operating systems on my key ring of operating systems that I was talking about is just a completely blank vanilla install of a beautiful little free software operating system called Bodhi, which is designed to be pretty in the same way that Apple stuff is designed to be pretty. We gave nothing to Steve about that. We know pretty too. He patented pretty from time to time to try and stop us from having pretty. The patents on typography in OS X, and before that in the last non-free software OSs for Macintosh computers, patenting type looking good, that was the kind of stuff that he did. But we beat his patents, destroyed them, invented around them. We do pretty. So one of the things that I keep on that key ring is just a pure blank install of Bode. It looks nice. The browsers have never been used. They have no history. Nothing has ever happened to that image. And each time I put it in a computer, it's completely fresh, as though the computer had never been used before by anybody. And each time I'm done with it, I rewrite the bits on that little USB key. So no software ever runs twice. And anybody who thinks that they can find out anything about me from that laptop can't, because it's a laptop that's completely fresh and new and never been used before. And anybody who attacks that laptop is out of luck, because the minute I'm done with it, the software will be overwritten. Maybe you want one of those. Well, that's no problem. I mean, the software is all free. Nobody can stop you from having it. All I need to do is say to you, here are these bits. Let me show you how to get them in the machine. So when you start it up, that's what starts up. The laptop is an example, therefore, of a kind of federated computing in the hardware domain. Hardware that doesn't make any political assumptions, or rather whose political assumptions can be changed as easily as the USB key in the slot. Hardware that wants to be flexible and that does not want to be used against its user, but in its favor. Everybody here should be able to do that. Everybody here should know how to be able to teach everybody else who isn't here how to do that. Everybody would find it useful sometime. Except, of course, the Ministry of State Security and Facebook and all the people doing browser fingerprinting to find out who you are on every device you use and all those other things. Okay, see you next week.